All right. Hello, everybody. I am Nick Gillespie. I'm with Reason. This is the Reason Interview. It's a special live stream edition. And I am joined today by the heads or near heads of two of the largest libertarian student groups, student organization, Campus Present Groups, Students for Liberty and Young Americans for Liberty. My guests are Dr. Wolf von Lahr. Wolf, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Wolf is the CEO of Students for Liberty. And we're joined also by Sean Tima, who is the Chief Operating Officer of Young Americans for Liberty. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Nick, thanks for having us.
Okay, so we're going to talk about the Charlie Kirk assassination, the leader of Turning Point USA, and what kind of reverberations and impact that's had on campus activism and campus organization and just the way that students are feeling, while also talking about what SFL and Young Americans for Liberty are up to on campus and how the receptivity towards libertarian ideas are going. Gents, thanks again for joining. Wolf, let's start with you. Where were you and what kind of conversation within your organization did you have, like when you got the news that not only was Charlie Kirk assassinated, which is, an unbelievable act of violence, but on a college campus? How did you respond?
I mean, pure and utter shock, of course. I mean, we didn't see any of that coming. And Charlie was a voice of a generation, right? And Gen Z is heavily influenced by him. And I think that is no secret. And of course, nobody agrees with everyone on everything, but like he was there, he was fighting the fight for free speech, and he brought it to the places that needed the most and which have shunned the ideas of free discourse. And certainly that was a shock. We jumped on a call with the senior leadership team immediately, then decided to reach out to have the students give them resources to reach out to anyone who is a TPUSA chapter leader or a staffer to just invite them to lunch or dinner to share the grief and just debate ideas to honor Charlie. So that was one of the first things that we did. Of course, we checked in with the students, how they're feeling. Some of them, of course, were scared. Some of them, are on campus, obviously, and having those discussions and were taken aback, to put it mildly. And we made sure that they're okay, that they have the resources to continue to do the things that are relevant, but also keep them safe.
Yeah.
And we also have seen, like, since we are not only in the U.S., I mean, the audience probably gets that my accent is not from Alabama, right?
Right.
We are an international
it's
organization.
More of a Mississippi accent, really?
Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say.
It's Mississippi,
as,
yeah.
Doesn't work very well, unfortunately. But I also see there's a lot of interest from the Global South specifically as well, because they know if you are targeting people with different ideas, that crosshair will move at some point towards you if you don't completely decry that and fight that and do even more free speech. And so we have actually seen like events being organized as far as in Spain where they talked about Charlie and his ideas and how classical liberal ideas are compared to that. So those are a few of the things that we have seen in the immediate aftermath of his killing.
Sean, how about how did Yale respond? I mean, where were you? You guys are headquartered in Austin. How did it hit the HQ there?
Yeah, like a ton of bricks. And I'll never forget where I was. I was up in the air flying to Washington, D.C. when all this was unfolding and we heard the terrible news and, President Trump's post announcing his death. When I landed in D.C., the person I met for dinner, one of the people I was with, was State Representative Laurel Libby, who, as the viewers may know, was censured by the state legislature for speaking her mind. That case went to the Supreme Court and she won, but she had been stripped of her right to speak. She also had been targeted with threats, death threats, violence, her family. And she shared with me, her daughter said to her in the wake of this, "Does this mean you're going to stop speaking?" And she said, "No, absolutely not. The time to stand up and speak truth and stand for liberty now matters more than ever." And so our founder and CEO, Jeff, he encapsulated a similar message directly to our students, our whole network, saying, to honor Charlie's memory and what he was out there fighting for, we have to double down and continue to be even more present on campuses, spreading the message of liberty, of libertarian ideas, of peace and prosperity. And I really want to, shout out and be grateful for our in-house staff, folks like Trenton Rippey and Colin O'Mealy and Daniel Gonzalez and others, who the very next day, they went down to the University of Texas Austin campus and went out there with signs, support free speech, stand with Charlie, you know, support the First Amendment, to let other students know, hey, there are still going to be groups out there who are going to fight for your right to speak freely and fight against censorship. And they were met with three very different kinds of students that day on that emotionally charged day. They were met with students who scurried away from them and maybe seemed like they wanted to talk to them, but were scared because the campus climate was so rough and so, you know, volatile. So students whose speech had been chilled, students who were very hateful, who were very angry, you know, quasi spitting in their face and, you know, get out of here, calling them a fascist. So the left was in full force, very angry, wanted to continue the momentum of shutting speech down. But then we ran into another section of students who were even more animated and saying, you know, thank you for being out here. I mean, this is incredible. Like, I've been on the fence about stepping up and speaking my mind about liberty. And now I know I have support and I'm all in. Like, put me to work. Where do I go from here? And what this is being realized as is that there will be a greater amount of a small irate minority of students who are animated by this, who realize the threats to liberty are real, the threats to free speech are real. And this has inspired a whole new generation of folks who know that the time is now to step up, speak freely, and fight for the ideas of liberty.
Yeah. Wolf, could you explain a little bit, what is Students for Liberty's kind of campus presence in North America? What are, you know, where are you, where are you strongest, and what are the types of campus activities that you're doing in this academic year?
Yeah, so we are actually doubling the size of our North American programs this year. It's the region where we spent most of our money on, even though I have a strange name and a strange accent, that was always the same, and we'll continue to do that as well. We are strong very much in Florida, on the East Coast. We even have some people in California, we believe in, you know. We were like more excited about that to hear that we have people in California than people having, you know, activities in Afghanistan. Which we also have. And what we do on campus is we're focusing heavily on students and we giving the tools and resources for them to become leaders. Meaning that we don't only give them the theoretical training about leadership skills, organizational skills, activism skills, communicational skills, but also put them in charge. To give you an idea, worldwide, last year, our students have organized events for 220,000 people worldwide. And that's the students doing that and not my staff. And so part of that is that the more students put in their sweat equity, the more they will not only bring about change to campuses today by sometimes suing universities, by sometimes events, by sometimes debates, but also in society in the future as academics, as journalists, as think tank leaders. And that's the long run theory sort of change that we have. And now we have over 12,000 alumni around the world that continue to fight for liberty. In that way.
Can I ask, in, you know, it's Students for Liberty. It's a group that grew out of, eventually out of a group that had been founded by a Cato intern or a Cato alum, if I'm remembering correctly. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But what's the core message? Because you're sending an, you know, you're part of an intellectual heritage that is explicitly libertarian. Do you give the students training in, you know, Hayek, Mises, Friedman, Rothbard, that type of thing as well?
Yes, it's leadership skills and it's education. And so our education is very PPE focused, so politics, philosophy, and economics. And so right now, which I'm pretty sure, Sean, you see this as well, students don't read as much anymore. It used to be that they come to our programs already super excited and have read like a bunch of Friedman and Mises and so forth. No, not so much anymore. So right now, before they even start becoming like very active on campus, they have to read iPencil, Frederick Bastiat's The Law, and also, what's the third one? Economics in One Lesson. And then they're getting quizzed on that. So we need to do like a little bit more groundwork compared to previous years. And then we have, of course, like a lot of debates because we have people who are objectivists, people who are more classical liberal, you know, all kinds of different folks. And we concentrate on the 90% how we're similar, not on the 10% we're different, and then having conversations about those ideas. So,
Sean, talk about Young Americans for Liberty's campus presence. I mean, I know you guys do door knocking campaigns where, you know, you get oftentimes student people to go out and actually campaign or knock on doors for candidates that you guys think at the state and local level, or I guess also sometimes at the federal level or national level, that fit a libertarian profile. But Young Americans for Liberty grew out of Ron Paul's presidential campaigns. What are you doing on campuses these days, and what kinds of kids are showing up for that?
Absolutely. Yeah. At the end of the day, you know, we want to see our states in this country turn into beacons of freedom. And a lot of that comes from legislators being elected and policies being changed. But none of that works without the youth army that starts on our college campuses across the country. So we're active on over 500 chapters across the United States. And we partner up with groups like the Atlas Society and Thee, and even Learn Liberty, you know, with SFL, to get students these resources on understanding the ideas of liberty, because we must be educated and our students must understand that liberty is the answer, you know, not big government. Everything must flow from there. But we also believe that education is but the servant to mobilization. If we're really going to fight for liberty and get real tangible wins, we have to step up, organize, and take action. And so a big portion of our student focus on these campuses is our student rights campaign, which is a concerted effort not only to educate students about the ideas of liberty, but also to get them to step up and make policy change happen on their campus right here, right now. Yes. You know, we've changed over 200 often unconstitutional policies on campuses across the country, free speech zones, for example, right? Teaching students on how to say, hey, are you upset that there's a free speech zone on this campus and that we're only allowed to actually hold free speech events on this small square portion of the campus? Does that upset you? Do you know about it? If so, sign up, come to our meeting, and let's talk more about free speech. So letting students know about the threats to their freedom and introducing them to the ideas of liberty based on the policies right on their campus, then teaching them how to organize and how to petition and demand their freedom back from decision makers, right? Just like you would a politician, it's the same thing for the university president or the dean of students, how to deliver petitions to their office, how to hold a rally, put pressure campaigns on these people to say, hey, if you do not give us our freedom back, our right to self-defense, our right to free speech, our right to not be tracked with a Bluetooth app under the guise of COVID safety, which was a crazy thing that happened during COVID. They were tracking all the kids' phones. If you do not give us our freedom back, we'll come for your job and we'll demand you resign, right?
Yeah, so, if I may just to chime in, Young Americans for Liberty follows a kind of tactic of confrontational politics, some of which you're describing here. Could you summarize what that means and what are the big issues on campuses? You go for free speech, you go for constitutional carry, is that right?
Some campuses we go for that, some we go for tasers, but yeah, absolutely. So,
but it's this confrontational politics model. Could you explain that a little bit?
Absolutely. So, paint a picture for you of you want to change AOC's mind and get her to vote in accordance with liberty. Do you hand her a constitution and hand her a copy of, you know, a Robert Nozick book or a Murray Rothbard book and expect her to educate her way into understanding, wow, I've been wrong all these years? No, because that's not her incentive, right? And it's not going to happen. You can't change a politician's heart and mind, but you can say, hey, if you do not behave the way I want you to, if you do not vote the way I want you to, then we may come for your seat. You may lose voters. We're presenting demonstrable proof of angry voters. On this case on campus, it's demonstrable proof of angry customers, students who are aware that their rights are being threatened, and they're going directly to those decision makers, the college presidents, the dean of students, saying, hey, you know, for example, at the South Dakota School of Mines, you know, we've collected over a third of the campus has signed a petition that says, we want the right to self-defense. We want the right to carry guns on campus. Or, you know, Florida State University, we've collected a quarter of signatures on campus saying, we want the right to carry pepper spray. Some schools don't even allow you to carry pepper spray on campus, which is ridiculous. You know, if you do not pass this policy, we're going to cause you some good trouble, right? And so it's this notion of saying, if you want your freedom in the position of a bureaucrat or a politician, you must demand it. You must demand it peacefully. And you must say, if you do not vote or change the policy the way we want you to, there will be consequences and we're not going away. And it's that small, irate minority of people who can do that. That's what local action looks like. And it's working.
Yeah. Wolf, tell me a bit about what issues that you, or maybe not issues per se, because I don't think you guys, I mean, you're obviously talking about libertarian ideas and free speech and free inquiry and academic freedom are first and foremost among those, but you're not quite going after issues in the way that Yale is. And, you know, this is division of labor, right? There are lots of different ways of kind of pushing libertarian ideas. What are the issues, the topics on campus that you find students are most responsive to that are coming through the SFL door?
That's an interesting question, and it really has changed from generation to generation. And sometimes we do work together with Young Americans for Liberty as well. Yep. I mean, we had a fantastic success starting at the University of Tennessee and then being in the whole state of Tennessee where we got rid of like taser bans, the pepper spray bans, which they have implemented. So affecting 250,000 students. And it was our leadership and, you know, some of our staff and some of, you know, Sean's team as well. And that's a beautiful thing. So some of the topics that we see resonating, I mean, right now, obviously, it's like more people are interested in free speech. So that is a good thing. And we have seen our students that are going out there and defending it more and more so because we need to. There's no alternative to it. Then I think Gen Z specifically is very interested in climate change, and we have specific arguments about like free market environmentalism. What are like non-statist means how we can help the environment without looking to be government? Mm-hmm. And so those are some of the arguments that resonate. But also the climate has changed quite a bit from when I was in school, when you were in school, Nick, all of us. Because right now,
when I was in school was literally a century, you know, in a different century. So
That makes sense.
Yeah, talk about what were the big issues when you were, and did you, were you in school in Europe or in the US or both?
Germany, Spain, and the UK.
Okay.
So mostly in Europe. I mean, I did a little bit of a stint at George Mason for my PhD, but that's it. But yeah, what right now is really different because like historically you thought you could talk about like free markets with conservatives and find like a lot of common ground. Mm-hmm. But like, if you then touch like on some of the issues, for instance, immigration, or if you touch on free trade, suddenly it moves into a very tribal realm. Mm-hmm. And then they're not like as eager to listen anymore. Where before that was all very common. The left wing of the students often don't even want to talk to you and see classical liberals, libertarians or like as white supremacists. What used to be like the fringe of the Liberal Party now has become like really mainstream, and it is hostile at times. And so what really works is trying to focus on issues that they're interested in. And what libertarianism is very good at is being adaptable and saying, okay, you care about like class struggle, let's say, you know, let's talk about what are the institutions that really live off the of the government and how can we undermine that and with the role of banks and so forth. So that's how you have to do it these days. But like, it's a very different environment.
And you also, Students for Liberty has a large, global presence. You mentioned the global South, or, you know, I know in Latin America and Africa, and also in parts of Europe and Asia, you guys are present. Are the issues that are important to students in North America, you know, are those the same ones everywhere, or are students overseas kind of dealing with very different issues at the top of their list?
Depends really on the region. I mean, give you one example. During the week where Charlie was assassinated, we organized a large-scale event at a university in Brazil about the Brazilian constitution and the rule of law. There, a mob of leftists attacked the speaker, our volunteers, as well as all of the attendees trying to shut it down. So this is unfortunately political violence, while even though it has been trending downward in the United States over the last, you know, decades, which is a good thing. And this is something worthy of mentioning because most people say like, oh, everything is getting worse, which is not the case. It is happening across the world. And so there has been a response, which is similar to the United States, focusing more on debate, getting out there more, which is all very good. But as you can imagine, in Africa, where you cannot even talk about some of these issues without being thrown in prison, or we have students in Nicaragua, where we don't know their faces or their names because it would be immediately probably killed. We have students that right now, they have been threatened repeatedly by the Taliban because of their activism in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. It's a very different environment. They have used very different terms. They don't use the term libertarianism. They talk about entrepreneurship or about like markets, not even free markets. So we are very Hayekian in that way, that it's all about like the local knowledge and trying to just give them the resources so that they can leverage their interests and their focuses in the way that is conducive to their environment while keeping them safe, but also, you know, pushing the envelope forward and bringing new arguments into debate that many of these regions desperately need.
Sean, could you talk where in the U.S. or North America? Because and you guys are fundamentally a U.S. organization, right?
That's correct. Yes, we operate in all 50 states.
Where are you strongest? Like where is the Yao message, you know, hitting hardest?
Yeah, I think it resonates in every part of the country a little bit differently, right? In California, you know, we have a strong base there because we have students who are saying, hey, I've grown up under the thumb of big government and the failures of the left when they've been in charge for 30 plus years and central planning and these failed policies, you know, based on, you know, intersectionality and woke gone wrong. So they're motivated by that. But then you've got students, you know, say in the South, who are growing up under the deep red legislature and a conservative culture. But then they have this light bulb moment where they say, you know, wait a minute, I can't carry pepper spray on campus. I can't own, you know, a gun without jumping through a ton of hoops to defend myself and my family. And wait a minute, these Republicans are actually voting to increase taxes and increase spending, making it unaffordable for me to buy a house and start a family compared to my parents' generation. You know, what's going on? I demand liberty. I'm going to get involved that way. So I'd say it's pretty spread out. But the one thing that's universal is that every college campus across the country where we have active Yao chapters, they are actively fighting the premise, you know, that I think we saw, you know, taken to its logical extremity with Charlie, which is that speech is violence, right? Or that censorship is good. And the extent that the students are having to deal with that on campus ranges from something that actually happened just yesterday out in Colorado. We had students at a school in Colorado. They blew up a big free speech beach ball, right? Which is probably our most popular activism event. Giant 10-foot beach ball. Students sign whatever they want on it to demonstrate anti-censorship and celebration of the First Amendment, really catches students' eyes. Some students ran by it and either with a pair of scissors or a pocket knife or something, just stabbed it, deflated it, right? This has happened before. And I think that comes from, you know, this this ethos from the professors that leads them to the logical conclusion of, oh, well, some speech is too dangerous and we have to shut it down no matter what. Even worse, a couple of years ago at Tulane, we had a student whose dorm room was set on fire because he was a Young Americans for Liberty member and people did not like what he was out there on campus saying and what he was standing for. And a couple of years before that, Kellogg Community College in Michigan, we had students who the administration said, stop handing out constitutions. It's against our policy. The students wouldn't stop doing it.
Yeah.
They called the campus police. The campus police put them in cuffs and they spent the night in jail for refusing to stop handing out the Constitution. Oh,
they must still be dining out on that, right? That's, you know, Henry David Thoreau's of the 21st century. What a look for college administrators, particularly if it's a state school, right? You know, throw people in jail for constitutions.
And they won that appeal, which is great.
Wolf, how would you, you know, one of the things that has changed in the kind of libertarian movement landscape, or rather the broader political landscape, is, you know, if you go back maybe 10 years or so, it seemed that, you know, liberals and conservatives understood that they needed, you know, that their standard package of ideas were kind of losing ground. Progressives and libertarians were in the mix. It seems like progressives have really come to fore on the left side of the political spectrum. You know, the Democratic Party, nobody's talking about, you know, the establishment. They're talking about the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. MAGA conservatism has really overtaken the Republican Party. How, you know, and there is on some level, you know, there are some overlaps between Trump or MAGA and libertarian ideas, but there's a lot of difference. How has the ascent of MAGA republicanism hurt the ability to reach more students on campus with the libertarian message? Or am I completely wrong in that?
No, you're not completely wrong. It has been confusing for students. And I think this is a message that we, all appreciate it, it's all the state's fault, right? Because in this case, also with universities, because they have been so captured by woke ideology and shutting down free speech, what Sean is talking about, I was nodding, like our students were experiencing the same thing, handing out the Constitution of the United States of America and then campus police showing up. Like, we have seen the same thing. It's outrageous. And those were the bastions where you typically have free speech, but they're not anymore any longer. And so where do students go? Students go online and then they're going to more and more fringe beliefs. And that's the reason why like characters like Nick Fuentes and so forth gaining so much steam, because their radical ideas are more interesting. Positioning classical liberal libertarian ideas as like, this is the middle way, doesn't work. Students want to see something that's like a little bit more drastic. And unfortunately, they're going to the extremes in a very bad way. And I consider that to be problematic. On the other hand, regarding like Trumpism, he was pushing back against a lot of those things. And now universities maybe don't have a DEI department anymore. It's called something else and it still continue to do that. It's still the establishment, but the grip has been loosened a little bit. But the conversation has moved from the quad to the algorithms. And we have to grow up with that as well and have those conversations online as well, because you cannot have that at universities that much anymore. Of course, we're doing in-person things and debates, but that only goes so far. We need to be in both realms.
Yeah. Sean, can you talk about the effects of COVID and the lockdowns, which it was better or worse in, you know, depending on where you were in the country, but it was always worse than it had been before COVID. How did that really put a pause on actual campus presence, and have things come back to normal, or is it still a struggle now? Like, has something changed in campus life where people just aren't hanging out in the quad the same way they used to be?
Yeah, well, the silver lining of the COVID lockdowns is it woke up an entire generation to, hey, this is the extent that the government can go to make your life miserable, right? I feel so bad for the high schoolers, the middle schoolers, the upcoming college graduates who had to put their graduations and their formative years on hold because of these shutdowns, these anti-science shutdowns that really didn't make anything better. It only made things worse. And there was a big pause when the campuses were totally shut down. And when they came back, for one thing, you know, we had to rebuild because by that time, a lot of student leaders had graduated. Some of the groups needed rebuilding. The silver lining, though, is that there were students who were raring to go to say, finally, I'm back. I want to get out there. I want to speak my mind. I want to take action. And the schools made it difficult for them. You may remember, you couldn't go back to some schools, many schools, unless you had the booster. And there was, a student who actually had his email shut down, as is a Yale student who was, attending Rutgers, and he was remote, for that semester because he wouldn't want to pay for board and housing with all the restrictions. And they figured out, oh, you don't have your booster, so we're actually canceling your email and we're canceling your classes. But I'm 100 miles from the campus. Doesn't matter. We're shutting you down. And it's things like that that really make students not trust the government. These universities themselves are just mini governments. And so it became an opportunity for us to seize on and say, hey, if you think this is bad, look at all the other ways the government is reducing the quality of your life, the quality of your future. So that was the silver lining.
That's a fascinating story. And thank you for reminding me of that. I went to Rutgers as an undergrad. I'm actually wearing a kind of ersatz Rutgers, Letterman, sweater as we speak. And I loved going there, understanding the limitations that all colleges have and things like that. But can I ask you, Sean, like how does Yale capitalize on that in a way that, that is distinct from kind of Trump MAGA people, or, in a more extreme way, somebody like a Nick Fuentes or, a Tucker Carlson at this point or something who just says, oh, this is, they just want you to get the shot. They want to put the jab in the arm, et cetera, and stay with us. We are in political power right now, and we hate vaccines just as much as you do, or mandatory vaccines, things like that. Can you talk a little bit about like, what does Yale bring special to that? Because this, I think, is something that all libertarians are facing. Like, there are points of massive disagreement and agreement at various points. And it seems like it's gotten harder for libertarians to remind people that there's something distinct and better ultimately and more principled than either, temporary alliances with the, you know, progressives on some things and conservatives on others.
Yeah, I think it all comes back to really channeling our focus for our students on the central truth that I believe to be true and I believe history shows to be true, is that if we radically reduce the size and scope of government, your quality of life and your future will improve. And the alternative and the inverse is true too, no matter who's in charge or no matter what thought leader is saying, hey, if we just were a little more authoritarian, if we just expanded government to do X, Y, Z, if we just spent more money, things will get better because we're in power. Time and time again, doesn't show out, it shows up to be a false bag of goods. So yeah. I'd say our distinct lane here is channeling students toward, look, there's going to be a lot of noise. There's going to be a lot of conspiracy theories out there. You can be, you know, so open-minded that your brain falls out. And the government has lied to us over and over again.
Right.
But we need to keep our eye on the ball and say, look, is the government growing bigger or smaller? If the government is growing smaller because of you stepping up and taking action, knocking on doors, calling your representative, running for office yourself, you know, getting your sea legs, changing policy on campus, you are more likely to live in peace and prosperity. You are more likely to buy a house, start a family. You are more likely to be happy and to flourish. And that is something that the government cannot give you, no matter who is the press secretary or the president or selling you that bag of goods. Only you can save yourself, not the politician.
Wolf, the Trump election last year, I guess a year ago, right? 2024 time, you know, and as an older man, this, you know, it's a mixed bag. Time seems to have slowed down. So that's kind of good because, you know, I got less runway in front of me. But on another level, it's kind of mind numbing. But when Trump was elected, it was signaled, you know, it supposedly signaled a vibe shift. There was also, you know, and where, okay, we're going to open things up a little bit and be a little bit more free thinking. Part of that was the COVID regimes were effectively over. And it's, you know, always worth pointing out that Trump started the COVID regimes, you know, including the national lockdown, et cetera. But, you know, it got really bad, mostly under, you know, kind of hard left or liberal to progressive governors, states and things like that. But there was this vibe shift. There was also a Supreme Court ruling that really, you know, said to Harvard, a private university, you know, the leading university by reputation in the country, as well as University of North Carolina, one of the great public research flagship universities in the country, you can't do affirmative or, you know, you can't block Asian students from coming here because you see them as somehow not as social as other people. I mean, there's a lot of shifts going on. Are you finding any new people coming in from the left? Also, maybe after the October 7th attacks, going back a couple of years, where I know I met a lot of adult liberals who, after October 7th and the way they saw campus responses saying, you know, not simply, you know, saying like a war is a bad thing, but openly praising Hamas and kind of terroristic violence, a lot of liberals saying, whatever I am, I'm not that. And if that's the left, I'm looking for something new. Are you seeing anything from the, you know, broadly speaking, the left on campuses where they're looking for something that is different from what they'd been hanging out in just, you know, recently?
I do think that's the case, specifically also after the Charlie Kirk assassination. When you were in social media, a lot of people said, like, whatever I am, I'm not that. When you looked at the people like really celebrating that death, and those people like looked depraved and just plain evil. And if you, one cannot call that out, you know, then there's something wrong with your moral worldview, I believe. And so that delineation between good versus evil played like a huge role. And we saw also like very interesting facts, like Bible sales went up and like more church attendance and all that kind of stuff. And that's why, you know, Turning Point is also successful, because they can offer that to their students. They have like a moral framework, which, you know, we, for instance, don't have. We allow people who are believers of different faith or non-believers to come in and have that discussion. So they have a leg over that. But I really do think that we have seen much more people coming from both sides of the aisle to classical liberal ideas, because they're sick of like some of that yelling that's going on and some of that radicalization. Like just in terms of our, you know, Twitter and Instagram and online, we just doubled all of that within the last, you know, 12 to 10 months. And we have not seen that growth before. And this is really uplifting, and that's where we have to recruit people. One other thing I would like to say about a question that you previously asked, Nick, is about like the ideas and how to differentiate ourselves. While we can still focus with Republicans on some of these aspects, I'm not entirely sure I agree that they, you know, don't want to have a big government. Because like American Compass and many of these organizations that are becoming like the mainstream of Republican thought say like, hey, we need strong unions. We need a strong government. We need like nation building and all that kind of different
industrial stuff. Policy is now part and parcel of the Republican Party. Yeah.
And their specific agenda is to what they say, like, get rid of libertarian economics, which is just economics, right? Which is just economics. And try to replace it with a Republican or conservative economics. And that is really, really problematic and can lead to many more frictions. And we have to come up with a good argument there. We are part of a few working groups trying to address that. Mm-hmm. But I think we need more of a libertarian argument against like those really, really bad statist ideas.
Yeah. How about immigration, you know, and kind of foreign students? This, you know, is an interesting thing right now, where foreign students are, you know, under a microscope for a couple of different reasons. Sometimes it's because of, you know, pro-Palestinian or pro-Hamas or a speech that is critical of Israel. You know, the Trump administration is actually targeting some students who are here on student visas and whatnot. But there's also xenophobia and things like that coming from the right. Does that... And, you know, and then in a weird way, the left has never been that comfortable with immigration. So, I mean, how does the immigration issue play out for your Students for Liberty chapters?
I can give you like a very pragmatic answer.
And I realize now I am talking to an immigrant himself, so...
Yeah, and certainly. And I was here on an H-1B visa doing Trump's first term, and it affected me negatively in some way as well. And so now I needed to switch gears, but that's less important than what's happening to the students. Because we used to have like a lot of events here in America. We brought a lot of international students to them because the best way how you can teach a young mind about the ideas of liberty is like, yes, hand them a book and hopefully they read it, but also have like peer-to-peer education.
Yeah.
And if they're interested in what the effects of socialism is and then talk to like a grandchild of someone who was in a gulag, then liberty gets a completely different quality to them. Or when they talk to like our Venezuelan students and so forth, and they bring something like this here, right? This is a turtle made out of the Venezuelan currency, right? Because they're making art out of it now, and because there's nothing else that they can do with that currency. Then our ideas become reality. We cannot do that much anymore because it is so difficult to get people here. My chief of staff is from Nigeria, lives in the UK. He cannot get a visa for years and years and years. And that is just pretty sad. But generally, I think the conversation has become like more nuanced about immigration, where not many people scream for like, oh, like open borders, everything. And then, but the people saying like the system that we have right now is too restrictive, which actually also is harming American interests too.
Yeah. Sean, welcome back. Thank you for a short disconnect there. No worries with that. How does Ron Paul continue to, or let me rephrase that. How does that kind of essential message of Ron Paul, which, you know, when he ran for president in 2008, 2012, really caught fire, not just with a lot of people, but especially college campuses. And you had this, you know, whatever he was then, a septuagenarian, or he might have been an octogenarian then, right? Because he just turned 90. You guys threw a wonderful birthday party for him. But I mean, he was packing college campuses, and you have, you know, a 85-year-old or an 80-year-old OBGYN, you know, speaking to college students, coming out, and like, his message was really radically simple, which is that you own your life and you should be allowed to live it the way that you want. Does that still ring true with students? Or are they like, yeah, that's kind of nice, but what I really want to do is smote my enemy? Because it seems like at the national level, you know, conservatives or MAGA Republicans and kind of, you know, harder core left wingers, it's all about, you know, throwing dirt on the other person rather than kind of being your own thing.
Yeah. Well, first, I'm very grateful that Dr. Paul has had a resurgence in the media these last couple of years. I think alternative media and X and Twitter has made a big difference on that, getting his ideas to a whole new generation of students through that platform. And so he's still very relevant for the students today. They still look at him and say, hey, this is the vanguard of the ideas. That excitement once introduced to Dr. Paul is still very much there. And I think what differentiates Dr. Paul, if I may quote, right, I had a coworker at a summer job. I was working at a winery. I was delivering the wine like 4 a.m. And my co-driver, she was one of those crystal ladies, right? And she loved Ron Paul. And she said, you know, Ron is the light. Ron is the light. And I think that's what separates him out from maybe some of these newer voices or this new attitude, you know, of pugilism and punishing our enemy as a way to spread liberty. It's Ron said, no, liberty's for everybody. We're going to have a positive message of liberty, and we're going to achieve those aims, you know, through that lightness, right? Rather than chasing it through darkness. And, you know, to your point about crushing the enemy, I think that Young Americans for Liberty and SFL and classical liberals and libertarians at large have a taller task in front of them now than they did when I was in school, right? About 10 years ago, in the sense that we can't just win people over to our ideas, but we also need to win them over to the notion of that we cannot and will not be successful in spreading our ideas through force or in becoming the monsters we seek to destroy, right? Very tempting to get that ring of power and to use that ring of power in government to crush our enemies and to say, you know, we've had 10 years of woke. It's time to punch back and put these people in jail and censor these people. That only, you know, makes the pendulum that much more likely to swing back and forward. Yeah. And even if, let's just say, even if it doesn't, let's just say the pendulum's stuck and say, nope, there's, you know, right of woke is dead, right of center capture, you know, to the end of time, you know, is that the highest use of our cause? Is that the, you know, the best way that we can live? Is that a world we want to live in? Or do we want to live in a world where everyone's free to prosper, where that ring of power is destroyed, and when we can all be free, right? And so I think we have to work twice as hard to spread that positive message, take the longer path to achieving the ends we want to achieve, because it is very tempting, right? At a primitive, just biological level to say, yep, I want to crush my enemy. But that will not lead to the long-term solutions and the safety and the prosperity that we need in this country and in society.
I'm going to ask my producer, who's off camera, Paul, if you have some questions or comments that you pulled from Twitter or YouTube, if you can throw them in the StreamYard chat. I'll bring those to Sean Tima and Dr. Wolfan Lahr, my guests of Students for Liberty and Young Americans for Liberty. Let me ask a demographic question, and I'll start with you, Wolf. We may have hit peak college, right? You know, the number of people who are going to college, the number of younger people is declining and things like that. Yeah, it was always taken for granted. And, you know, I started reading Reason in the late 70s. So this is, you know, a million years ago. I joined Reason in 1993, 1,000 years ago. And it was always everybody. There's a great early 70s New York Times magazine article that was written by one of the guys who went on to co-found Wired magazine, Louis Rossetto. And he it was called like "Are Libertarians the Next Big Student Movement?" Like it was always, you know, it's always been a live kind of idea that if we can just get the students, whatever your ideology is, if you win the students, you win the future. What if there are fewer students? You know, are you adapting at all to that? Or do you find that that's just wrong and that, you know, the cadres of the future, the people who really make difference in society, in business, in culture, in politics, really get rooted through college campuses?
I think this is still largely the case. I mean, I think the skepticism of higher education is a good thing. I happen to have all the degrees, but like if I get like a candidate who has started a business and failed at it, I would look at them more favorable than somebody with a political science degree. It's because they have done something in the real world. And I think that skepticism is warranted. I do think that still a lot of people will go through university, and we see millions of them every year. And so therefore we cannot give up on that. Point one. Point two is also we don't have to affect everyone. We all know that, I mean, social scientific studies show like if you have a committed minority of like around 10% of people, you can change the course of country entirely. And so we are focusing on the students that really want to be the movers and shakers.
Yeah.
We talked about COVID earlier. one of our students, Ethan Yang, during COVID, he was requesting a FOIA request from the government, like what happened in terms of the exchanges between the government and some of the social media companies. He got all of that information, and then later on, Missouri versus Biden was filed, which then like showed us all like how much actually the Biden administration was put pressure on for the social media companies to walk the company line or like the government line. And so this is a kid barely like 25 years old who was able to do this, and now he has published like a book and works on the Hill actually. Mm-hmm. And those are the people that we're finding, that we're building up, that we're giving confidence and a bigger vision for themselves and for the nation. And I think that's what we need to continue to do. It's a long run play, but that's the theory of change that we are following.
Sean, are the I know you have an interest in kind of performing and theater and things like that. Where do you see, along with college campuses, that is like one of the battlegrounds. Are there, you know, places outside of colleges or, you know, in kind of the cultural arena that you see kind of green shoots about a new, and it might be, you know, it might be more intellectual or it might be more confrontational kind of version of libertarianism really kind of coming to the fore in the culture more broadly?
Yeah, I think that the best ways to organize those spaces, you know, there are groups out there that are doing a great job, as opposed to there's one specific, I guess, genre or industry or like hub, like, oh, theater, music, sports. Yeah. You have, you know, the Free State Project, for example. I was just catching up with Eric Brakey yesterday, and they have, mm-hmm. you know,
right. Who is the head of, is the head of the Free State Project. He had been a state senator from Maine who was quite successful, and he had a long affiliation with Young Americans for Liberty. You guys helped shape him, but also helped get him elected as well.
Precisely. And, you know, it's for him, it's about getting libertarians and liberty lovers together. And once we, you know, get together and create the space where we can be together, doesn't matter what we do, as long as we're bonding and, you know, building that community where we can then do greater things together, mm-hmm. achieve, you know, more policy wins, more cultural victories. America's Future, run by Eric Cohn and Emma Aerforth, great folks. They also do a great job at this with mm-hmm. happy hours and going to sporting events and just really creating the space for like-minded people to come together. Because I think that's on campuses too, the biggest hurdle and the biggest appeal, initial appeal for student groups. I remember when I started my Yale chapter, the feedback from the first meeting from several folks was like, yeah, I've been in college like 3 years and I never knew there were people like me, but now I'm excited. We're all here and we're together. And yeah. So I think that there needs to be a continuation of this momentum of saying, we're here, you are not alone. Let's do anything, right? Versus saying, hey, let's go and, you know, take over the sports industry and make that pro-liberty. I think we start decentralized and the best idea and the best industry will emerge up from that.
Dr. Wolf, can you, how long have you been at Students for Liberty? And how did you get involved? Like, what's your superhero or supervillain origin story? How did you end up becoming part of the libertarian movement with a capital L, capital M, trying to create more libertarians and take over the world and then leave it alone?
Thank you for the question, Dr. Nick. So I emerged as during the financial recession of 2008 and 2009, because I started to Google, like, what is the explanation for this? Because the media narrative in Germany, and I'm pretty sure it was the same in America, was like the fall of the banks or, you know, it's mm-hmm. capitalism's fault. And those
Unfettered capitalism, unregulated capitalism. This is what happens when you don't have guardrails, et cetera.
Correct. The neoliberalism, you know, which right now, ironically, is like something that the right is talking about a lot, like the neoliberal globalists. So it has moved from the left to the right now, which is funny. But yeah, so I started to Google and I found out about Mises, Hayek, and Rothbard, and started to reading about the Austrian business cycle theory. Mm-hmm. And I actually published a little book under my neo-Keynesian professor who allowed me to write about this. And I was really hooked. At that time, I was actually active in party politics a little bit on the youth level, mm-hmm. but I realized it's only about money and positions and never about the ideas. Mm-hmm. And then during the same time, Students for Liberty entered in my life, and I was a volunteer back then studying Austrian economics and a master's degree in Spain. And mm-hmm. I was mostly, I think, maybe 30% focusing on my master's, 70% focusing on Students for Liberty. and built a movement there. And I saw like what Sean was just talking about, like, oh, there are other people with my ideas in Europe. That's amazing. And we organized an event and there was like 200 people and I didn't sleep for like, you know, 3 days, but I had more energy than ever in my life. And I said like, this is it. And now I'm grateful that for 10 years now, I'm the CEO at Students for Liberty, or soon to be 10 years. And I want to give students the same kind of perspective and experience that they realize like, hey, I can do bigger and better things. Because universities just teach like nothing really in terms of like you becoming who you want to be and like what you can accomplish in the world. And that bigger vision, that confidence we're instilling in students, and that each time when I'm seeing that, where now like a 20-year-old wants to publish books or protest or become like the libertarian Charlie Kirk, you know, it warms my heart that young people see this, because neither universities nor schools are giving that perspective to young folks, and somebody has to.
Sean, how about you? How did you, you mentioned you started a Young Americans for Liberty chapter in your college. Where was that? And was that how, like, did you come across Young Americans for Liberty in college and that's what set you on your course?
Yeah. So I came into college freshman year, guns a-blazing, super excited to learn how to be the next Michael Bloomberg and Michael Moore. I was someone in high school who was very animated by these, you know, big government ideas of the left and this notion of, hey, if we just had the right people in power to have the right taxes and orchestrate society and central plan the right way, then we can lift people out of poverty, right? That's the bag of goods I was sold by, again, people like Bloomberg and Howard Zinn and Michael Moore. And when I got to class, I'm sitting in class. I'm like, okay, I can't wait to learn about all these solutions and how we can solve our problems. But instead, I just got, you know, hit in the face with a big old dose of critical theory, which is a bummer because, you know, it was all about, you know, how we are doomed. The professor's ethos was, oh, America's damned. Capitalism can only, you know, make the poorer poorer and we can never be rich and you're doomed. And Fidel Castro, he did some bad things, but he gave everyone free eye exams. And, you know, if you're a man, especially a white man, you should be giving 100% of your income to and your house, your future house to people of color. And we can't say the word suicide because not every religion sees suicide as a bad thing. So it's a microaggression. And just like all this liberal lunacy.
Where can I ask where
was this? Was Ithaca College, which I am grateful that those professors were not censored or in fear of saying these crazy things, because it made me think, you know, maybe I'm not meant for the left and maybe the Democratic Party of today is not actually where I want to go to help people and lift people up. But where do I go? And thanks to some excellent on-campus recruiting and awareness, I found about a YAL. I found out about philosophers like Nozick and Friedman and Rothbard. I found out about the modern day champions like Amash and Thomas Massey and Rand Paul. And I saw these guys leading and communicating with integrity and putting solutions forward and saying, hey, the government isn't the answer, but here's how we can make your life better. And that all inspired me to say, well, I think I found the right path. Let me start this YAL chapter and go from here. And I think that's why I'm so animated by and bullish on, you know, changing the hearts and minds of college students by just giving them small doses of, hey, this is how the world really works, right? The government cannot solve your problems. These radical ideas on the far left, right, they're only going to lead to, you know, becoming a doomer to speak Gen Z and not to the real solutions you're looking for.
Wolf, if you had to recommend somebody listening to this, particularly a younger person, you know, one book or one, I don't know, work of art or documentary, something to watch to kind of get energized about what Students for Liberty is trying to do, you know, where would you point them?
It's an excellent question, because the first thing that popped into my head would be like, what has government done to our money? Which would be Murray Rothbard's book. That's not really regarding Students for Liberty, but I do believe like once you understand the role of money in society and how much that has been undermined by the Federal Reserve, then you're going to be, you know, stuck as a classical liberal, whereby if you, for instance, understand why the war on drugs is stupid and antithetical to our goals and will always harm more people than it will help people, you can become a socialist later on. Mm-hmm. So for me, I think the economic ideas and having the principles is the best thing to first.
And ultimately about actual money and currency, the, you know, the I was going to say the lifeblood of an economy, but it's almost like the corpuscles, right, or the blood cells. And you are also very interested in Bitcoin and Bitcoin, not crypto per se.
Thank you.
I mean, that's not like an official SFL thing, but does the emergence of Bitcoin, or has the emergence of Bitcoin been the kind of source for a lot of newly minted libertarian students, do you think?
Often. It really depends on the country and what they're interested in. But right now, we are not only talking about Bitcoin, and the students can talk about whatever they want to talk about, even like cryptos. But I personally think that those things are mostly very dangerous and people should stay away from it. However, we paying 20 out of my staff members are being paid in Bitcoin. We're actually using it in the business since 2015. It is important to us and actually reduce transaction costs within the business. And my staff can ask to be reimbursed in Bitcoin instead of USD or whatever currency.
Will you pay them in Trump coins? Does that work or no? Okay.
No, not going to touch any of that scammy stuff. And you know, you can fault Trump for that for sure. That was like a money grab that was not necessary whatsoever. So we do see a lot of people being interested in those of things and in Bitcoin specifically. And we have seen students come to SFL because we're talking about that. And it has become a lifeline for them. We had like a student that escaped the military dictatorship in Myanmar. And the only reason why he was able to escape the country is because he brought like the few thousand dollars that he had in savings with Bitcoin over the border that otherwise he would not be able to do. So it has become a literal lifeline for folks, and then they try to understand, okay, what are the ideas behind Bitcoin, and then they come to classic liberal organizations like ours.
Oh, that's amazing. I mean, you know, that this is an old story in Bitcoin communities, but it is a fascinating one where you could, if you could memorize your keys, you could literally walk across a border with millions of dollars, and be free in a way that it's just unthinkable when you're talking about most kinds of currencies and things like that. That's fascinating. Sean, is there a book, a movie, a novel, a play that, you know, you think particularly sells libertarian ideas in a way that young people might take particular notice of?
Yeah. So for books, absolutely would recommend The Revolution of Manifesto and Liberty Defined, both by Dr. Ron Paul. I think that provides a really good picture of not only issue by issue, alphabetized definition of, hey, this is, you know, how we can define, you know, liberty and the right paths forward. That was very helpful for me. But the Revolution Manifesto also captures, you know, the zeitgeist of 2007 and, you know, the financial crisis and why the Federal Reserve and what that's doing to our money. So I think those are great intro reads for anyone. And then as far as media, you know, I have to give a shout out to Emergent Order Foundation and also to the Moving Picture Institute, both of whom I think are creating video content that sneaks in classical liberal and libertarian ideas to people without hitting them over the head with it. You can watch, you know, some of these movies and some of these, videos they put out and not know that you're actually watching, dare I say, libertarian propaganda. But by the end of it, you're like, oh, no, that's common sense to me. Of course we should have school choice. Of course we shouldn't be, you know, having a huge climate tax to try and solve climate change. So I think they're doing a really great job, Emergent Order and Moving Picture Institute.
Yeah. We're going to wrap up in just a minute. But Wolf, where is the best place for people to find information about Students for Liberty?
Absolutely. And thanks for doing this. This was a very engaging conversation. I appreciate it and very needed. Studentsforliberty.org. And if you look for SFL Liberty on Twitter and Instagram and all of those different other platforms, you will find us.
Great. Thank you. And Sean, what about Young Americans for Liberty?
Our handles across all major platforms is at YA Liberty. That's one L in there. And at YALiberty.org.
All right. I want to thank Students for Liberty CEO, Dr. Wolf von Lahr, for joining me, as well as Young Americans for Liberty Chief Operating Officer, Sean Tima. Thanks so much, guys. And we'll see you again soon, I'm sure, out in the real world, as well as some, you know, skating out here on the internet as well.
I hope so.
Thank you, Nick.